Well, today we are indeed fortunate in having with us Mr. Tabo Ndenke, who is currently the director of the ANC's Department of International Affairs, a member of the organization's executive committee, and according to the press, a leading candidate for the post of president of the ANC, if the current president, Oliver Tambo, who is ill, is unable to resume his duties. I want to give you a little background on Mr. Tambo, on Mr. Ndenke, and then turn it over to him. Tabo was born in 1942 in the Transkei. He was one of four children and the son of Govan Ndenke, a founding member of the ANC and a member of the South African Communist Party, who was imprisoned along with Nelson Mandela until 1987, when he was released and then placed under restrictions. Tabo became involved in the ANC Youth League in the 1960s, and after the organization was banned following the Sharpeville shootings, he became involved in the ANC underground in the 1960s also, working in Pretoria and with Witwatersrand areas. He left South Africa in 1962, but was arrested in what was then Rhodesia and jailed for 6 weeks while the authorities prepared to deport him back to South Africa. The matter was raised in the British House of Commons, and Ndenke was later granted asylum in Tanzania after the intervention of Julius Nyerere. He subsequently left for the UK to study at the University of Sussex, where he earned a master's in economics in 1966. He continued to work in the ANC International Student Committee and the ANC London office. He went for military training in the Soviet Union in 1970, and then went to Botswana, Zambia, Swaziland, and Nigeria, where he represented the ANC, finally arriving at ANC headquarters, where he has remained. He was appointed to the National Executive Committee in 1975, became political secretary in the Office of the President in 1978, director for information in 1985, and he also serves on the ANC's Political and Military Council. This year, he became director of international affairs, which many people regard as one of the most important posts in the organization. Writing in the Washington Times, Peter Younghusband recently described Mr. Ndenke's credentials as a diplomat as impeccable, making him thereby suitable for the job as president. However, he noted that nobody knows what Mr. Ndenke's ideology is. What makes him particularly suitable, he noted, is that he has held so many senior positions within the ANC. Nevertheless, Younghusband predicted that the stage seems to be set for Mr. Ndenke to take over as president of the ANC at the next consultative conference of the organization in 1990. This, of course, is an extremely timely appearance for Mr. Ndenke, given the changes that are occurring in South Africa. And I also want to extend a note of thanks to him before he even speaks, because he went to extraordinary lengths to be here today, both in rescheduling his schedule after there was some breakdown in communications on the date, and then in dealing with canceled flights last night. So I would like to welcome Mr. Ndenke.
I'm sure that with Peter Younghusband as a friend, I don't need enemies. I understand that everybody here is very knowledgeable about South Africa. So it's a bit of a difficult task to talk about South Africa to an audience that knows about South Africa. So I've been told that I need to be very brief because of that, so that we can then discuss seriously the issues which everybody present would want to discuss. I'll try to be brief. Don't believe the biography that Pauline has just given. I will correct it later. I think it's clear that many people in the world are expecting that Change must come to South Africa soon. Assistant Secretary Hank Cohen the other day was talking about a new generation of leaders having taken over in South Africa, and presumably a new generation of leaders that would come with new ideas and a new program of action. But our reading of the situation is this. that first of all, and very fundamental, is that the National Party went to the elections on the 6th of September on an apartheid platform. Whatever de Klerk says about a mandate for change and a mandate for renewal, they went to those elections on an apartheid platform. Said fundamentally that groups are basic to any political restructuring of South Africa. Repeated in other words, positions that this leadership of the National Party had taken when P.W. Botha was president of South Africa. I think that's important because one senses that the things that have been said by de Klerk since then are what is believed. When he says 70% of the whites voted for reform and renewal, 70% counting the votes of the Democratic Party, it's in fact not true. In terms of the platform on which the National Party campaigned, I think that's an important element. The South African regime continues to believe that any new constitution has to be built on the basis of groups, however defined. And de Klerk sometimes says that we must move away from a racial definition of groups to a cultural definition of groups, but always groups. And this is apartheid. I know that the Democratic Party is not very pleased to have been co-opted by de Klerk to be counted among the 70% that he claims is a mandate for renewal, because of course they stood on a completely different platform, on a platform which specifically addressed the issue of groups and group rights and said you cannot abolish apartheid by writing up a new constitution based on the notion of groups. I think the people present here will remember a problem that arose for the National Party sometime in May. It illustrates the problem that this leadership faces. Sometime in May this year, the then Minister of Constitutional Planning and Development, I think that's the title of minister, made a major speech, his last major speech in the White Parliament. It was Chris Hiernis. And Hiernis said that they had come to realize that their propagation of the notion of groups was an obstacle to a negotiated resolution of the South African question, because people read that notion as meaning the perpetration of apartheid. They had therefore decided, said Hiernis, to move away from that concept and to put forward another notion that the South African people should be considered as one group, as one nation, as one South African nation, but that having done that, they would then recognize the democratic right of anybody to dissociate from that South African group. De Klerk publicly rebuked Hiernis and said Hiernis was not reflecting party policy, Hiernis was representing his views, and Hiernis was talking about something that was in discussion within the National Party, but it was not National Party policy. So Hiernis resigned from the National Party. I think that's a very important point to bear in mind, that the present leadership of the National Party, led by F.W. de Klerk, continues to say we need change, but change based on a recognition of the separation, division of the South African population. South Africa is composed of many nations, those sorts of problems. Apartheid. I think that's one reality. I think the second reality, which is important to the South African situation, is that the struggle against apartheid is continuing, will continue in all of its forms. It doesn't matter really what the South African police or the South African army do. You are going to get more and more people involved in that struggle in all of its forms. Therefore, the pressures, the internal pressures against the apartheid regime will continue and will intensify. I give you a little example, but an important example from the point of view of our own history and our own politics. You had a notion emerging at a time when the state of emergency, as a result of the state of emergency, many people were in detention. Organizations banned, restricted, and so on. When press restrictions, also when people did not see much mass public political activity as we are seeing now. The idea that the people had got immobilized, that the regime had seized the initiative, that it had kind of pushed us backward. Well, one of the things that was happening during this period was that, in fact, new forces were entering into the struggle. I want to give one example of this, which I'm saying is a very important example. There has been formed in South Africa an organization called the Congress of Traditional Leaders of South Africa, CONTRALES. It's an organization of chiefs. This audience, knowing about South Africa as much as it does, will of course remember that when the ANC was formed, the chiefs in the region, the kings, played a very central role to the formation of the ANC, to the extent that there was a House of Chiefs. The constitution of the ANC provided for a House of Chiefs, and the chiefs would attend the annual conference of the ANC as chiefs. In the course of time, of course, they were all absorbed into the administrative structures of the country and became ordinary, straightforward civil servants. The chiefs are coming round to the position that this was wrong, that they need to go back to the original position where they were part of this popular struggle for the liberation of their own people. That's why they formed the Congress of Traditional Leaders, an affiliate of the United Democratic Front, drawing in many of the chiefs into that organization. We had a meeting with a very big delegation of theirs about 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago in Lusaka. I'm mentioning that because that's a sector of the community which it was assumed would forever remain the layer within the Bantustan system which would help to run apartheid for the apartheid regime, for the Pretoria regime. Chiefs are turning around. This happens during the period of the state of emergency, when there is an apparent immobility. I think if you look at the New York Times, I read this morning as I was coming, reporting about the reburial of King Sawata Talingiyebo in the Transkei. This took place over the weekend. This organization, CONTRALES, was very important in organizing that funeral. Sabata Dalingiyebo, member of the ANC, who died in Lusaka, nephew to Nelson Mandela, a cousin to the Matanzimas, important traditional leader of the Tembo people in the Transkei. And I'm saying CONTRALES played a very important role in organizing the reburial of Sabata. And a good part of the leadership of the democratic movement was there. So you had a very big, big funeral taking place there. That's an illustration of the failure of the state of emergency to stop the development of the struggle, to stop the development of organizations committed to struggle against apartheid. So I'm saying that a fundamental factor of the South African situation is a continuing and an intensifying struggle against apartheid. So, what's going to happen as a result of those two things? It's perfectly clear that the de Klerk regime cannot stand still. It would like to stand still. It would like to make the sorts of statements that de Klerk has been making, that it's got a mandate for renewal, make all manner of promises, do all sorts of things, but in fact not move. That's what it would prefer. For instance, when it wants to address the issue of the Group Areas Act, lots of demands, as everybody knows, that to demonstrate movement forward, this regime must repeal the Group Areas Act, among others. And so what does de Klerk say? He says, yes, yes, we agree that the Group Areas Act should go, but let it be negotiated. Let all of us sit down, because you can't just repeal a law and that's the end to the matter. You've got to replace it with another. So let that be part of the process of negotiations, to remove the Group Areas Act, but to replace it with something else. In the meantime, yes, of course, we recognize the fact that certain of the major cities, certain parts of the major cities have become non-racial because black people have moved into white areas. We wouldn't want to send in the police to remove those. But we want to set up some kind of machinery whereby people can then go to that machinery to say the reason we live in the center of Johannesburg is because there was no alternative housing in Soweto, and those people will then look for alternative housing and so on. In the meantime, we'll be negotiating a change to this legislation. So de Klerk would want, therefore, the world to believe that, yes, I want to repeal the Group Areas Act, for which he would want applause. And then proceed to do all manner of other things to ensure that the Group Areas Act remains on statute book. That's what he'd like to do. But I'm saying there is an ongoing struggle, there's an intensifying struggle, which is creating problems for de Klerk. And therefore, despite an unwillingness to move and lack of readiness to move, he has to move. And we think he will move in this direction. That he will begin the process of the release of political prisoners. I'm talking about the most senior political leaders in the country. Because he has no choice really but to move. To release some of those most senior political leaders in the country. And then invite them to sit down to talk. De Klerk uses a formula in terms of who is to sit down and negotiate a new constitution. And the formula is elected leaders as well as recognized leaders. Now, the elected leaders, according to de Klerk, are the people who serve in the apartheid institutions, whether it's the tricameral parliament or the Bantustans or the African municipal councils, those are the elected leaders. So he wants those. And the recognized leaders, Mandela and Tambo and people like that. So what you would therefore do is to say, we release these leaders and invite them into a process of negotiation which would include both them as recognized leaders and the elected leaders. In three phases, there's a phase one, during which everybody would be determining the goals. What goals do we pursue when we say we want a change in South Africa? And we spend 2 years discussing goals. Then, having determined the goals, you then spend another 2 years discussing obstacles. What obstacles are there to the realization of the goals to which we have agreed? And then you spend the fifth year drawing up a new constitution. Now, of course, if a Nelson Mandela were to be released and then proceeds to sit with his so-called elected leaders, two things would have happened. One is that we would then have recognized these apartheid institutions as legitimate. The people who would have sat there as leaders of the Bantustans and the Tricameral and so on, we would have said, by virtue of our sitting down and negotiating such a new constitution, we would have said, yes, these people are representative, so representative anyway of sectors of the South African population that they need to sit here. That's one thing we would have done. The second thing we would have done is, of course, that we would have recognized precisely the point that the Clerk wants to make, that South Africa, South African population is defined in terms of groups. So they would have sat with the recognized leaders there, the Zulu group and the Swazi group and the Colored group and the Indian group and so on, and of course out of that would have got a group constitution. So it must be clear therefore to this audience that none of that is going to happen. No Mandela or ANC is going to be sitting in any constitution making mechanism which is composed in that manner. But I'm saying that that's what the Clerk would want. So, there is obviously, therefore, a very wide gap between ourselves and the Clerk as to what to do about South Africa, where he says groups and group rights, and we say a non-racial democracy. So we go in different ways. So I think, therefore, the perspective must be clear. I'm talking about the situation as it is now. The perspective must be clear that you have in South Africa a situation of a continuing conflict. Not the situation which the Clerk is trying to portray, a situation which is pregnant with change. Because it does not seem to us that the leadership of the National Party is ready for real change. There are many questions that the Clerk will have to address if he became ready for real change. He inherits a state system which P.W. Botha constructed, dominated by the military establishment, security establishment. And quite clearly, the Clerk will not be able to move if and when he becomes ready for real change without having addressed the role of that security establishment, whose view is that it is strong enough and the ANC is weak, and therefore they are strong enough to be able to maintain the system for as long as they wish. And therefore don't see any particular need to go for fundamental change. I'm saying that's just one element which the Clerk would have to address if and when he becomes ready to deal with the question of real change in South Africa. Of course, one of the reasons that the Clerk has got to move, like for instance on the issue of political prisoners, is because of international pressures. I don't think it needs to be said here, but the South African economy is clearly in very bad shape. The governor of the South African Reserve Bank, Gerard de Kock, just before he died, in his last major statement, said, South African economy is in a bad shape, it's getting worse, and there's no way of redressing that, changing that direction, without addressing fundamental questions of political and constitutional changes. That the rest of the world was not going to deal with South Africa in the way that South Africa, the Pretoria regime, would like it dealt with until there's fundamental political change within South Africa. It's an important point of pressure. It would therefore seem to us that what we hear coming from Washington is a bit disturbing, that there is a general view that's emerged that the Clerk should be given a chance We don't quite understand we're given a chance to do what. Because in terms of what we understand De Klerk to be after, he's after the perpetuation of apartheid. So you give him a chance, you give him a chance to perpetuate apartheid. The state of emergency is imposed by state president. It decrees that there must be a state of emergency. Why hasn't De Klerk abolished the state of emergency? If he wanted to change, if he wanted movement, he could have done that. It wouldn't take very long. P.W. Botha instituted a system of a review system to assist him to get the political prisoners released. It takes a judge who goes and sees the political prisoners and says, ask some foolish questions, and recommends to the Minister of Justice, and it happens. Release takes place. That's a matter that can be done in 24 hours, if De Klerk wanted to release the political prisoner. I'm saying there are many things that he could do. A few weeks ago, there was, as you'll remember, a demonstration, a planned demonstration, on one of the beaches in the Western Cape, the Strand. And that beach had two signs, white only, and next to it was no dogs allowed. On the day of the demonstration, the police cordoned off the beach and they put up notices. Access to the beach not allowed because there is a police dog exercise. Demonstration was due to take place this weekend, same beach. And all notices are gone. Dogs can come, black people can come. It took 5 minutes to remove those posts. Many people got injured in that demonstration. But yesterday, was it yesterday, day before yesterday, they were celebrating. They said, well, since the signs are gone, let us, Bishop Tutu said, let God's children come and celebrate. I'm saying, there are many things that De Klerk could have done in the days that he's been acting president and now state president, which he has not done. Because he's not willing to do that. Not because he hasn't got the capacity, legal or otherwise, to do that. Because he's not willing. So to say give De Klerk a chance, I'm saying it's a bit disturbing. It would seem to us that that is sending a wrong message. To say let us give him 6 months, as I understand it, position here. Let's give him 6 months, and after which, if he doesn't do anything, then we will consider further measures. It would seem to us that now is the time for the world precisely to say, if you are a new generation of leaders, then you've got to act now as that new generation of leaders. And as far as we are concerned, apartheid is there, a white minority government remains in place, and therefore the rest of the world acts now to put those additional pressures. So in terms of a perspective, I can't quite remember what the title or the formal title of this discussion is this morning. I'm saying in terms of a perspective, what we foresee is a continuing struggle, a continuing conflict, and would want to say to the rest of the world that the rest of the world must continue to increase pressures against this regime for an end to apartheid. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Under which the United States, led by the South African government, the United States would not impose additional sanctions. These conditions include things like ending the state of emergency, unbanning the ANC, releasing political prisoners without restrictions. But they don't include what you were talking about just now, which is a genuine willingness to negotiate with genuine representatives of the majority. In fact, as I read it, the ANC OAU statement recently also distinguished between preconditions for negotiation, like the ones I described, and then all the things that you would do once you started negotiations, committing to democracy, negotiating with liberation, and suspending violence. Do you think that those in Washington who are discussing kinds of conditions I mentioned earlier should add to them something regarding who would participate in the negotiations, that they be with genuine representatives of the black majority.
What have been called preconditions? I suppose they are preconditions, but for negotiations. But essentially what we're saying, when we're saying release political prisoners and ban organizations, end the state of emergency, all that kind of thing, what we're really saying is this, that if there is to be a political process for the resolution of this problem, then it is necessary that all political players in this situation should have the possibility to act politically, should in a sense proceed from the same positions, from the same vantage point. The National Party does not have any of its leaders in prison. No element of the National Party is banned. I've never heard of a meeting of the National Party being banned under the state of emergency, any of this. And so if the National Party wants to say that, yes, we're ready to negotiate with the ANC, I'm saying, why don't we start from the same vantage point? If de Klerk is able to go and address his constituency to say, look, I want to negotiate with the ANC and I want to say the following things, it surely must be possible for Oliver Tambo to do the same thing with his constituency. So in that sense, they're not preconditions to negotiations. It's really establishing the situation where everybody else can act as a political party to participate in that process. And that is why, as you see, the document which originating from the ANC and the Democratic Movement, which OAU adopted and later the non-aligned movement, that's why we raise those questions. They're not preconditions to negotiations. They are, as we say, the creation of the climate, the enabling of all political actors to be able to act politically in this. Now, as far as the rest is concerned, it's quite clear. It's quite clear that it would not be possible to arrive at a political solution to the South African question if the ruling party continues to treat the issue of groups and group rights as non-negotiable. The issue that in order to construct a new constitution, you must move from the notion of groups. This is your building stones. It's clear that you can't reach a negotiated resolution of this question. Because as I was saying, this is apartheid. Now, this is not to say there are problems about questions, for instance, of language. We say very clearly that everybody is entitled to the use of their language and religion, culture, that sort of thing. But not to construct a constitution which defines the political actors in terms of groups. It's clear that so long as the regime persists in that sort of position, you cannot have a negotiated resolution of the South African question, because clearly we are not going to agree that in order to end apartheid, you perpetuate apartheid. We cannot agree to such a position. So, I think it would be correct. I think it would be correct for the rest of the world to make that point. I think this point has been made by very many governments, that what we are after is a democratic South Africa in which all South Africans participate in the formation of their government and so on. That's a correct position. And I think it is correct to say that precisely the reason that South Africa is in crisis today is because, apart from the exclusion of the overwhelming majority of the people, it's an exclusion based on this notion of groups. And whatever guise you put it under, whether you're saying they're cultural groups rather than racial groups, so long as you've got this notion of groups as your foundation stone to any new political order, so long will you have conflict in South Africa. And therefore, I think it would be important for the rest of the world to say that it is opposed to that. It is opposed. That's apartheid.
Herman Nickel, do I understand you correctly that you're saying that you totally reject the concept of group rights, but that that he would be prepared to negotiate so long as the government itself says that group rights are an issue which can be talked about and negotiated as well. Are you going so far as to say that the government, so long as it, that you will not negotiate, so long as the government sticks by its group position? Do you think that the government at the moment says that there cannot be negotiation about the group concept? The second question is, who else should be at the table? Nelson Mandela, at the time of the Commonwealth Persons Group, indicated that he thought that, for example, Buthelezi must be at the table. He falls into the category of elected leaders, I suppose, that W. Duclert has talked about. You indicate here that for you to sit down with people like that would imply acceptance on your part of a group concept. Can you clarify your position on that particular issue? Who is it going to be at the table?
What I was saying is that it is not possible to arrive at a political resolution of the South African question so long as the National Party insists that the group notion is not negotiable. It isn't. You couldn't arrive at any resolution of this matter. What we have said in the document that is being referred to now, called the OAU document, is this: that it's necessary to create a climate conducive to negotiation. This is release of political prisoners, etc. That once that was done, it would then be necessary for ourselves and the Pretoria regime to sit down and discuss the question of a suspension of hostilities, I think that's the phrase that is used, an end to the physical confrontation. Get to a position where both sides agree that the bombs are going to stop and the police will stop shooting, the army will stop shooting and all that sort of thing. That would be the second thing that would happen, well, the first thing that would happen in terms of the negotiating process, in terms of our view. The second thing that would happen is that we would then sit down to say, what are the basic fundamental principles that should underlie a new constitution? So you have negotiations about those sorts of principles. What de Klerk, as I was saying earlier, calls goals. Now, quite clearly, we are saying that, of course, de Klerk would come to those discussions about principles, carrying his group concept. And we would debate that and say it is wrong, you can't have a group concept and say you are ending a party. If at that stage de Klerk says this is a non-negotiable, those discussions couldn't go very far. But obviously, if de Klerk comes to those discussions and say, well, as National Party, this is our policy, but we've entered into negotiations, and to enter into negotiations mean that we must find compromises, then we're dealing with a different set of circumstances. So I was saying, so long as the National Party insists on the issue of groups as being non-negotiable, you cannot find the resolution, a political resolution, in the South African question.
And the second part of the question would be the
coming. Okay. I hope that's now, with regard to the second question, the fundamental political divide in South Africa, is between forces on the one side that say we want a non-racial democracy, and on the other, group rights people and whatever other rights. This is a fundamental political divide in South Africa. It would be our view that when you entered into negotiations, you would find more or less the political forces in the country divided in that way, more or less. And it would seem to us that, therefore, What, for instance, the ANC would have to do is to say, why don't all of us who stand for a non-racial democracy get together in order to talk to whoever our interlocutors are on the other side of the table? Now, obviously, there are people who are serving in the apartheid institutions who themselves say that they are in favor of a non-racial democracy. You have Bantustan leaders who are saying that they don't support the Bantustan policy. They are people in South Africa, and they would like to become South African like anybody else, participate in democratic processes and so on. These are people who would presumably therefore come over to that camp which represents that non-racial democracy. Not as people who are going to come and negotiate for the place of the Kangwane Bantustan in the future negotiation, in the future constitutional dispensation, but people who, I'm saying, see themselves as part of that non-racial democratic camp and want to make a contribution to the transformation of South Africa, not in terms of groups, but in terms of a united country, a non-racial country, and a democratic country. Now, I don't know in what way Chief Buthelezi would define himself. I don't know. In a sense, that's up to him. You know very well the conflict that is going on in Natal. We were of the view and continue to be of the view that it's very important that that conflict should be resolved. So the ANC, very keen that that killing must stop. The ANC thought that it should try and encourage everybody in the country to get together to talk and resolve this issue. So we spoke to the UDF, we spoke to COSATU, we spoke to church people, we spoke to business people, we spoke to press people in Natal and said it's absolutely necessary that this killing must stop. So in the end, everybody agreed, and UDF, COSATU, and INCATA started meeting. They met and agreed to very many important things about how to end the violence in Natal. We said to them as they were meeting that the African National Congress would be ready to meet all three of them if the three thought it was necessary that the ANC should be brought in that manner. And they took that decision and they said, yes, we would like to meet the ANC. So we said, fine. Where, when, so on. So what they decided was that there would be four delegations, each one of 20 people, each one led by the respective presidents, so delegations of INCATA, COSATU, UDF, and ANC, each one led by their presidents. Chief Buthelezi said to meet in London to look at what had been agreed by the three parties, endorse it, change it, and look at the process that was visualized. I think you will have seen this, that in the last few days, the INCATA Central Committee met and decided to break off those discussions. Because at a certain point, Chief Buthelezi says, this agreement having been reached, the ANC having said, yes, we're going to participate, Chief Buthelezi says, the UDF, COSATU, and the ANC are, after all, one thing. So they must come with one delegation of 20, and we of INCATA will come with a delegation of 20. So of course we say, but how can the ANC be the same thing as COSATU and UDF? Well, not the same thing. You will have to have three different delegations. And the issue of numbers is not important. We said that each one of those three could send a delegation of five, and Chief Buthelezi could send 1,000 people if you wish. It makes no difference to him. Second point that Chief Buthelezi raised was that he wanted a personal invitation from Oliver Tambo, which must be signed by Oliver Tambo. This is after the three of them had invited the ANC to come into the process. He turns around, he says, no, I want a personal invitation from Oliver Tambo. If those two things don't happen, the amalgamation of UDF, COSATU, and ANC, and this invitation from Oliver Tambo, I'm not coming to the meeting. In the meantime, people are dying there. Well, subsequently, Gajab Telis wrote a letter to Oliver Tambo inviting him. But so he invites Oliver Tambo, then takes a decision in the Central Committee to say they're not going anywhere, any further with this process. So it's collapsed. Now, I'm telling you that story to say this. The way in which people act is what, in our view, defines where they stand in terms of this fundamental divide in South African politics. It's difficult for us to understand that one can be in favor of a democratic South Africa, a non-racial South Africa, a South Africa at peace, and at the same time do all manner of things designed to generate conflict, designed to perpetuate the dying that is taking place in China. But I'm saying, come back to your original question. Yes, indeed, we would expect that people like Enos Mabuza and others, some of the ones in the independent Bantustans, would want to belong to this broad group which represents that non-racial democracy. And I'm quite sure the ANC would have no problem with that.
Armistead Lee, retired Foreign Service officer and secretary of the Committee for Peaceful Progress in South Africa. I'd like to ask a follow-up on what Steve Weissman asked about conditions. And it seemed to me that you were saying, as a precondition, that you could not sit down with elected leaders. Well, for instance, you couldn't have Hendriksen at the table, could you? And I wonder whether, if that is a precondition, because that requires your acknowledging apartheid, being a devil's advocate and reversing the roles here, how would you answer the governments saying we can't sit down with the ANC as long as all methods of protest, which means the Umkhonto bombings, continue, because we can't negotiate under intimidation of landmines? I mean, isn't it tit for tat? Or can you say that we can't negotiate if they insist on group protections as non-negotiable, but if you then say we insist on rejecting any form of group protection, even the sort that exists in some other multiracial or multilingual ethnic democracies that aren't being called apartheid, why aren't you setting just as rigid a precondition?
No, I don't think so. I think we're virtually setting no conditions at all. As I was saying, all we're saying is that as step number one in the process of beginning to draw up a new constitution, we should all of us sit down and come and present our principles. We are not even saying that the National Party must renounce its positions on groups and group rights. We're not saying that. They can come, let them come with their package, that's okay. No, but the point I was making about Alan Hendriksen and others is that we cannot conceivably accept a negotiating mechanism constructed on the basis of the apartheid structures that exist to say, for instance, that the colored people must be there and sit and negotiate. And Alan Hendriksen is going to represent the colored people. He doesn't represent the colored people. He doesn't. Oh, you look at this last election. These ones that took place now on the 6th of March. And then you would get the Indian House, the House of Delegates. You can't say that those people who are there represent the Indian people. Apart from which, we couldn't accept the notion that there is a political grouping called India. There's no such political grouping, as there is no political grouping called Zulu. Precisely, you know, you get this thing. I saw it in the New York Times the other day. A very good friend of mine, correspondent of New York Times in South Africa, I was a bit surprised to see that. then there is a factor of the Zulu people led by Chief Buthelezi. There's no such thing. You know, there's a conflict that is going on in Natal. It's been going for a long time. It's very intense. It's very sharp. Who is fighting? This is the majority of the African population in this area is Zulu. And it's Zulu people who are fighting. But it's not an inter-Zulu faction fight, but also it isn't. It demonstrates precisely the point that you can't say because people are Zulu, therefore they must constitute a political bloc. They don't constitute a political bloc. These are South Africans. Now, so I'm saying that we wouldn't accept the notion that there is a Zulu political bloc which must be represented by Gata Buthelezi in the constitution made. I'm saying the basic fundamental political divide in South Africa is between people who represent a non-racial democracy. And there are all manner of colors and races and all manner of things. Those people, they are Zulu, they are Afrikaner, they are this, they are in the Democratic Party, they are in the ANC, they are in the Council of Churches, the Catholic Bishops Conference, they are all over the place, they are traditional chiefs. And what unites them is this perspective, not color or ethnicity or anything of the sort. And I'm saying that it is possible that that group should get together. And if Alan Hendrickse wants to define himself as belonging to that group, he's welcome to that group. But not as a representative of a political bloc called colored. It doesn't exist.
Yes,
Tom,
from the Defense Department. I'd like to explore another area. Several times in your presentation, you indicated that the struggle in all of its forms.
An area.
Oh, several times in your presentation, you indicated that the struggle in all of its forms will intensify. But I think with the relocation of ANC to Tanzania and Uganda, has reduced your ability to launch operations. In Tanzania, for example, the security forces have taken charge of all ANC arms and weapons. In Uganda, the president has told U.S. officials that it was only a political gesture that he made by allowing ANC to relocate there. ANC is attached to NRA units in Uganda. It seems that their ability to act has been reduced. What are you doing to convince these governments to give you a freer hand? Both have indicated privately and publicly to people that no military strikes will be launched from their territories. I just appreciate your comments on that.
No, thanks for the information. I'm sure I think it's clear you know a bit more than I do about these things. The relocation of ANC military personnel doesn't have any impact at all, really, on the capacity of the ANC to conduct military operations. You will remember that there was a lot of talk in the media that now that the ANC is moving from Angola, this is going to affect this military capacity, they are moving further away and all of this sort of thing. And we're saying that Angola has never shared borders with South Africa. Angola was, in terms of those of our military personnel there, was in a sense a military school. I mean, people went to school there and could go to school anywhere in the world. So you're not dealing with Angola as though, for instance, it were Mozambique sharing borders with South Africa and therefore of operational importance. So the removal of our people from Angola couldn't have any impact on operational capacity. I'm saying precisely because Angola could never be a base from which you then launched operations in South Africa. It's too far away. And that would hold for any other country that does not share borders with South Africa. So no, the relocation in itself doesn't affect that military capacity. As far as I know, we might have different information on this issue. There is no country on the African continent which is saying that the ANC should not conduct an armed struggle. No country which therefore would accept our military cadres, but say, we'll keep you here, this is a political gesture, but we don't want you to be doing anything like planning or preparing your people for carrying out military operations in South Africa. I don't know of any such country. So I don't know the information that you might have had from Angola, from Uganda and Tanzania, but certainly I really can't think of any country that is not saying the armed struggle continues.
Jim Denson, I'm a local counsel in international law. My question is sort of a follow-up.
Can you speak up for the people in the back?
My question is sort of a follow-up to Ambassador Nickel earlier as to who you bring to the table. But in addition to that, what is somewhat confusing to me is when you indicate that they have organized traditional leaders, but then you say that the Zulus and the Khoisas and the various tribal groups do not represent specific political entities. It's somewhat confusing to me. The follow-up to the ambassador's question was how you determine who sits at the table and if, whether or not you're talking to people such as Lucas Mangope, and if not, why not?
Yes, I'm sure it must to some extent, the situation must to some extent be confusing. For instance, part of the confusion is this. Chief Buthelezi is a minor Zulu chief. Minor Zulu chief. The Zulus have a king, a king's verity. But you will see it written all over the place that this is the traditional leader of the Zulus, Buthelezi. He's never been. In terms of the traditional structures of the Zulus, he's never been chief of the Zulus. He's chief of the Buthelezi clan. King Zwelithini is there. Doesn't say anything except what Gaja Buthelezi wants him to say, because Gaja Buthelezi pays him. His salary comes via from Pretoria via Gaja Buthelezi to King Zwelithini. Now, I don't know what Zwelithini would say if he were free to speak. I think in all likelihood he would say, we as Zulu-speaking people have for decades been very much part of the African National Congress. We have never ever defined a specific, unique Zulu political interest. We are part of the black population of South Africa, which suffers from apartheid in much the same way as any other section of the black population of South Africa. That our destiny lies very much together with the rest of the black people of this country. I think that's what Zwelithini might probably say. The fact that they are chiefs, they are traditional chiefs who want to play a role like the traditional chief like Zwelithini, doesn't mean that they lead communities that see themselves as separate, distinct entities. I was talking about King Sabata, who was buried over this weekend. King Sabata Dalindyebo died in Lusaka. Was driven away from the Transkei by the Bantustan administration there of Matanzima, and he came to Lusaka. He was ANC. And when King Sabata Dalindyebo spoke about the Tembus, he didn't say the Tembus have a distinct political interest. He said, as the traditional leader of these people, my task is to lead them into the struggle for a democratic South Africa. Not in pursuit of some distinct Tembu interest, because it doesn't exist. Mangope. Lots of problems, eh? Lots of problems. You must know that not very long ago, a lot of people died in this Bophuthatswana area, on the issue of forced removals, an attempt to incorporate some of these areas into Bophuthatswana. And the people were saying no. So the Bophuthatswana police come and the army and they shoot them. There's a treason trial that is going on there. Portions of the Bophuthatswana army rebelled, because they were saying that even those Bantustan elections 2 years ago were themselves rigged, and portions of the army rebelled, and Peter Mubota had to intervene and to put down that rebellion and to say you can now sleep well. to Mama. How do you deal with a person like this, who every day carries out very consistently and very enthusiastically the work of the Pretoria regime? What should we talk to Mangope about? Because it would seem to us that by his actions, Mangope has very much defined himself as a cog, an element in this whole structure of the apartheid system. And I think in that circumstance, it might be better to speak to the master rather than to the servant, I think.
Carl, back to the Carnegie again. I don't have enough place to stay.
Okay.
It's very nice to see you here, Thomas.
Okay.
In the places where people sit around speaking knowledge of the Washington these days about South Africa, there's a kind of knowing assertion that there really are contacts between the National Party and the ANC. And this idea is put forward as a reason to give to Clara Klein.
No, there aren't any. There aren't any contacts between the ANC and the National Party. You know, of course, that Nelson Mandela has been, over some time, been seen by representatives of the regime, leading up to that meeting with Peter Mokgosi. But Nelson Mandela has said in all of those meetings that he cannot represent the ANC because he has no possibility to consult and discuss with the rest of his colleagues in the leadership of the ANC. He's an individual, an important individual in the ANC, and will talk as he understands the situation. But if the regime wanted to talk to the ANC, they know where to find the National Executive Committee of the ANC. That's what he has said to them. But beyond that, no, there's been no contact between the ANC and the National Party. And one would guess that such contact would have to relate to a seriousness on the part of the regime to negotiate a resolution of this problem. And I think so long as they have not come to that conclusion, so long will they find it not necessary or ill-advised to establish direct contact with the ANC.
I think we have time for one last question in the back. Can you please speak up?
Philip Fisser, an African student at George Mason University. The Washington Times reported this morning that ANC met with Erdogan in London. You might not be at liberty to talk about the content, but I'm asking more. What do you see is the significance of a meeting like that, specifically in relation to there's been ongoing a lot of these meetings where white Jewish establishment groups have actually gone up to the ANC Committee Caucus in London. And it almost seems that there's, in a way, a negotiation process already started by these talks, discussions between the ANC and a whole range.
Well, I tell you who was there. Well, maybe let me say who was not there. Mike De Vries, the South African story as put out yesterday by the Johannesburg Sunday Times, said Mike De Vries, principal of the University of Stellenbosch, was there. Mike De Vries was not there. Secondly, the people who were meeting were not representing anybody except themselves. And not representing the Bruder Bond. I don't know which ones of them are members and which ones are not. They were not representing the Bruder Bond and were not representing the government. The third thing I would say about that is that some of them we've been in contact with, you know, many times in the past. And the people who were there were two professors from the University of Stellenbosch, Willy Esther Heise and Sam Richard Blanche. The editor-elect, editors are elected, what do you say, designate of De Berger, Willem de Klerk, rather to F.W. de Klerk and Louis Creed from the Deciduous Fruit Board. No, they came in their individual capacities. As I say, for some of these people, we've been in contact with them in the past. There is obviously a growing sector, even among the Afrikaner population of South Africa, who are saying that we are in the present crisis in which we are because of apartheid. Apartheid must go. How do we get rid of it? What do we replace it with? So a lot of white South Africans naturally come to the ANC to pose those sorts of questions. And if I'm saying, it's not the first time that we've met people like Professor Sam-Peter Blanche, who incidentally is in the Democratic Party and in the national leadership of the Democratic Party, not even in the National Party. You know, Willem de Klerk was the central person in negotiating the merger of the parties that ultimately formed the Democratic Party, and so on. So, I mean, these people have been in discussion with. So, as far as we're concerned, it was, in that sense, a routine sort of meeting. But we think it is important that that interaction should take place, because, among other things, it enables us certainly to represent ANC positions and not to allow those ANC positions to be represented by de Klerk, F.W. of Water, or anybody else. Because naturally questions come up that, you know, the ANC is this, the ANC wants a one-party state, the ANC wants to drive white people to the sea, and so on. We're able to discuss those questions, as I say, represent our own positions. And also to discuss a very important question: how do we all of us act together to end apartheid? So that process will continue. I'm sure there'll be more white South Africans coming to see the ANC. But as I say, none of the ones that came as Broederbond, representing Broederbond, or a group from within the Broederbond, and didn't come to represent government.
I wonder, in conclusion, if you'd be willing to comment on the notion that you raised in your talk about greater pressure from the United States. What pressure specifically would you like to see the United States exert at this critical point?
It's very important that we come back to this question of sanctions. Our representative in Washington, Lindiwe Mabuza, and myself were in New York a few days ago in a meeting which was addressed by Assistant Secretary Herman Cohen. And I was very pleased to hear a very strong statement from Herman Cohen saying sanctions work. He was challenged from the audience. Somebody stood up and said, but are you really being quite honest, or whatever word was used? And he said, yeah. We have seen that sanctions work. And therefore, it's an important point of pressure, an important instrument in the struggle to end the apartheid system. I thought that was a very good position for the U.S. administration to take. Now, so what we're saying, let us use this instrument which works. We have understood that the U.S. administration wants, as it were, national consensus on the issue of apartheid, wants a bipartisan policy. We agree with that. But we would think that overwhelming opinion is in the United States, and correct opinion, that additional pressures need to be put on the South African issue. And therefore, we would want to see both Congress and the administration act together to impose additional sanctions. It's very important that there is action on this issue of the debt rescheduling, the rescheduling of South African debt, which is on the agenda now and must be rescheduled by June next year, that positions are taken on that issue against debt rescheduling and other forms of financial sanctions. So I'm saying essentially that that's a very important area in which to move, because one of the dangerous things that is happening now is that a situation is being created which is going to convince F.W. de Klerk that really all you need to do to ensure that the world doesn't act against apartheid is to make nice promises, which is entirely all that he has done. To make nice promises, and therefore bought himself time. And if that works to buy himself time, why shouldn't he use it? As I was saying earlier, maybe when he sees that promises, the time for promises is running out, then he will fiddle with one little thing or another, and they will say, now he's now beginning to move. Let's give him a chance. I think it's very important to address the question of sanctions and to address it now. I think it's very important that the U.S. administration should use its, I am sure, not inconsiderable influence over some of its Western allies to persuade them to move on the issue of sanctions. The Japanese and the others, the West Germans. If sanctions work, as Hank Cohen has said, I think it's necessary to persuade those major trading partners, those major economic partners of South Africa, as part of U.S. government policy, to persuade them to move on the issue of sanctions in addition to what the United States itself should do. I think it's also important, we have been very pleased with the way in which the present administration has related up to now to the democratic movement in South Africa. Archbishop Tutu and Alan Busak and Albertina Sisulu and all these people have been to Washington, have been properly received. We're very pleased about that. It's a good step forward to recognize that these forces are not forces that should be ignored in the interest of some so-called constructive engagement, that no solution is possible without these forces. That's important. But that should not become replacement of policy. It's a good thing. It's a nice thing. It makes good headlines. It's pleasing to our hearts. But there ought to be action also to increase the pressure on the regime to do these things, to use this instrument that works, to oblige the regime to understand that the world is tired of waiting on the basis of promises, on the basis of fiddling around with apartheid at the edges, that the world, United States included, wants apartheid ended, and so long as that thing is, there's no movement, we are going to take these actions.
Thank you very much for a comprehensive and very clear statement.